what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, team of Bentley Benz, but you moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.
Happy Monday, everyone. You are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley, and I am just getting back from the Congressional Black Caucus that was in Washington, D.C. I had an unbelievable time. I met Iyanla Van Zant, and she actually fixed my life, you guys. You know her show, Iyanla Fixed My Life. And I interviewed Al Sharpton live on his show, which I didn't know I was going to do, and I was extremely nervous interviewing Al Sharpton. And I also got commitments from a lot of people to come on the show, such as Victoria Powell, who's also known as Drusilla Winters on The Young and the Restless, Dr. Robin Smith, who is a doctor on the OWN channel. She's a doctor along with Dr. Oz, who kind of comes on and talks about different remedies. You would know her face definitely if you see her. But she's committed to coming on the show. MC Light, who is a pioneer for female rappers, and I actually thought I was MC Light when I was younger, but only my name was MC Sylvie Seal. And NBA player and now author Derek Anderson, just to name a few people. So get your minds right because this show is moving to another level starting tonight. My guest is an author from Seattle, Washington, and when asked why he writes, he stated, "Nothing has affected me as much as reading has. Dickens, Tolkien, and Lewis raised me. And while I walked through my own hell, made my own mistakes, and found my own redemption, there have always been books. And I write because I remember. I write because I still dream." It is my pleasure to welcome to the show New York Times, USA Today, and Wall Street Journal best author Ryan Winfield. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Well, hi there, Sylvia. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. It is my honor and pleasure. Compare what reading does for you versus what writing does for you.
Well, if there's one regret I have about becoming a full-time writer, it's that I don't get to read as much as I used to. And the reason for that is I try not to read while I'm actively writing to avoid somebody else's voice creeping into whatever I might be writing. And then when I do get to take a break, I have this, you know, backlog of books that I really want to read, but I need to balance that with resting my eyes and, you know, things like that. So I miss reading, but I do read a lot. And they're definitely different experiences. You know, to me, reading is a very magical thing, being transported to another world. So I still love it.
Okay. So do you consider yourself, I've been wondering this because I've read your book, and so do you consider yourself to be introverted or extroverted?
I would consider myself to be introverted.
Hmm.
And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
What's that?
Go ahead.
I'll tell you why. I say that. I think the primary difference is I think I do very well in public settings. I really enjoy interacting with people, but I don't recharge there. When I'm doing things like that, I really enjoy it, but I always come away tired. And I really recharge in a setting where I'm alone and where I can think. And so I would say that I'm an introvert. I know people who are the opposite, who have a difficult time being alone, and they really recharge and always need to be surrounded by people. So the skill set of being able to communicate with people is there, but I recharge when I'm alone.
Hmm. I'm the extroverted person that recharges around people.
Well, you're in the perfect business.
Well, after reading your book, I thought to myself, this guy has to be introverted or quiet, who observes a lot, who thinks a lot, is probably extremely romantic, and is definitely a dreamer. That's the impression that I got of you as an author after reading your book. When did writing become a passion for you, Ryan?
It had always been. I had written all my life, always at least journaling or writing poetry or hacking at outlining stories. But I didn't start taking it really seriously until I started taking screenwriting classes and training myself formally to write screenplays in about 2006. And my first novel, South of Bixby Bridge, actually began as an original screenplay that I had written and couldn't find anybody to buy or do anything with, and the story wouldn't leave me alone, so I began writing it as a novel.
Hmm. Now, did you major in English or journalism in school?
No, I majored in trouble.
In trouble?
Yeah.
So in hindsight, do you think things would have been easier for you if you studied English or journalism or not?
I don't know. I mean, I have a profound interest in language and how it works, and that passion for learning has never left me, and that I cherish more than anything. And I have friends who went on, were very diligent about schooling, and I don't know whether the experience drained them of their passion for knowledge or passion for their curiosity, but they seem to, once they're done with school, they're done, and their personal pursuits are in other areas. So I wouldn't change a thing.
Right. So for all of our listeners who are out there, we are talking with Ryan Winfield. And, you know, there are some people that wonder if they should, you know, major in English or journalism to write a book. Or they feel like, well, I didn't take up writing. I'm not a good writer, so I don't know if I can write a book. But you pretty much can major or do whatever and still write a book. Now, I'm not letting you off the hook. You said you majored in trouble. What did you mean by that?
Well, I grew up in a small town in north of Seattle, up by the Canadian border, called Bellingham, and it's about 50,000 people. And it was a beautiful place to grow up geographically. We had a beautiful bay. It's very gorgeous, but I couldn't wait to get out of there. I felt suffocated by the town. And I didn't have a really positive experience at home, number one, is where it began, but I didn't have a very positive experience with teachers or with the school system there. So I spent most of my high school years across the street smoking pot with the trouble crowd and then fled the town when I was 18 as soon as I could for Seattle and then ultimately for California, where I spent about a decade.
Oh, okay. So you said that books help you to escape. Who are some of the authors that you grew up reading and who inspired you to write?
Well, when I was very young, I read C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia. Most people are familiar with it. They've been made into movies now. But I read those. I got my hands on those, and I read them over and over again until the covers were falling off. And I read Tolkien, who wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And I read Dickens and Oliver Twist and all that. And so reading was a big thing to me. It was my escape. It was a way to get out of the family situation I was in. It was a way for me to get out of the town that I was in. And I really owe a great debt to those men, I think, because they found a way to tell stories that were interesting, and they were able to put themselves and some sense of morality, some sense of, when I say they raised me, that's what I mean, is they managed to instill some sense of something in me that I was able to fall back on when I needed it. And they did that in a non-preachy way and in a way that was interesting. I don't know anybody who wants to read essays, but I know a lot of people who love to read stories. So them. And then later I discovered other writers and had my imagination sparked in different ways. My favorite living author is probably Cormac McCarthy. And he's a very different writer, but the things that he's able to do with language and the images that they call up in your mind when you're reading, that to me is very profound. So I like a lot of different writers for a lot of different reasons.
Right. Now, you talked about, writing books helping you escape. For me, basketball was my outlet, and it really helped keep me focused on my goals as a youngster. When I grew up in a very small hometown and was a hyper child who was often very bored in a city of Steubenville, Ohio. And so basketball just really helped keep me out of trouble. It helped keep me focused. Do you find, you talked about a little bit that you were the kid that was smoking pot and getting into trouble. Do you find that you were able to use reading as an outlet to help you, when you felt like you were, that troubled kid or just kind of looking for things to do?
I certainly think so. I mean, I don't know where I would be had I not had books. It certainly wasn't enough to keep me from traveling down a path that was trouble. I was a very troubled youth, and I had a very difficult early period in my life and had needed to overcome a lot of personal demons. And those experiences have become great material to write about, and I do. I mean, everything that I write is in a way some kind of exploration of things that I've been through or I'm going through. So I wouldn't change those experiences either. But I think reading certainly helped, certainly early on, and I have no idea where I would be without it.
Okay, earlier we talked about you being a dreamer type of person. Are you that way every day, or is that a space and place that you go to when you write?
I think that that's a space. I mean, I'm human, and so I'm like everybody. I have good days and bad days, and I have days where the dream is so far away I couldn't see it. But I think it's a space that I go to when I write, when I'm in that creative mode and when I sit down and there's something that happens where the pad and the pen disappear, or the laptop if I'm typing, and it's almost like you're seeing something unfold and you're not creating it, you're watching it, and you're just simply getting it down as quickly as you can before it fades from your view. And that experience is very magical for me. The process is very magical and elusive, and I dream. I still dream.
And how and where do you find inspiration to write? Is there a certain place that you go to near the water or the mountains, or where do you find inspiration when you're writing?
I love to walk. Hiking and walking is my my standard mode is not being sedentary, but moving. And so when I'm walking, I go for a lot of walks on the waterfront here in the pier. I used to climb mountains, and I still go on hikes. And I find a lot of inspiration moving and being alone in my head. But inspiration comes from everywhere. And there are times when I can't find it. There are other times when there are so many ideas and so much inspiration, you can't hardly get it all down. There's a saying that I like. I think it's Steinbeck who said it, and that is that ideas are like rabbits. If you get one or two and you learn how to handle them, before you know it, you have more than you know what to do with. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with me now. I have notebooks filled with ideas and inspiration coming from everywhere, and so the challenge becomes, the discipline to focus that and complete something.
How do you, Ryan, how do you break out of a writer's block? I have periods of time where it's just really hard for me to be creative, and you just hit that brick wall in terms of just being creative. How do you break out of that writer's block when you have that?
Well, I try not to break out of it, because I think if the story has stopped coming to me, then there's a problem, and my fear would be to push through it and put something down that is forced or isn't authentic. So I don't try and break through it. Now, what I do is I write about other things. You can always write. So I might write about what I'm writing about. I might start this. I'm writing a story about and do some kind of free-form, freedom of association type writing. Or I might switch gears and write a poem that I think one of my characters would write. Or I might work on a song that I'm writing. Or I might go to a coffee shop that's really busy and set an egg timer for 30 minutes and take out a pad and a pen and just start writing as fast as I can without stopping. One long 30-minute run-on sentence without any care for spelling or punctuation. And when you do that, something really magical happens. About 10, 15 minutes in, you don't know what you're writing about. You've tapped into something subconscious, and when you read it back, sometimes there's some really great material there that can be mined and then typed up and shaped into something. So there's always writing you can do, but I'm not sure that it always makes sense to, if you're working on a manuscript or on a particular story, to try and force yourself to push through.
Wow, I'm going to try that. I'm going to try the whole 30-minute, set my timer for 30 minutes and just write and see what comes out. I love that.
The only rule to do that is that do not let your pen stop moving. It cannot stop moving. Because what you're trying to do is get rid of the internal editors that are in all of our brains, and that is your parents' voice or your pastor's voice or even the voice of your readers. What are they going to think of what I'm writing? And you're trying to get to something real and something deep that doesn't have any judgment associated with it. And so sometimes I'll start with a line, like today I'm writing about, or the first time I kissed a girl, or my mother always, or my mother never hugged me, and you just start writing. And you might, if nothing comes to you, then you just keep writing. The person next to me smells, and I don't know why they haven't washed their hair, and then they're drinking a latte, and I don't understand. And you just write, and then you break into something and start to lay some things down that you're unaware of what you're writing. So.
Wow. I'm really going to try that, and I'm going to let you know how it goes.
Okay.
We're going to take a short break, and after this break, we will be back to talk about your greatest timeout moments.
For a roundup of the week's events, interviews, and a whole lot more, tune in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern for the FSP Cruise Show, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. Here's a sample.
We have Mr. Stephen A. Smith. Hello, Stephen A. I'm glad to, this is Jerry, your host, along with my co-host Black and Jeff on here. Glad to,
What's up, fellas?
What's
up, fellas? How y'all doing?
What's going on, Stephen?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The FSP Crew Show. Information, motivation, variety.
You're listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley, and I am sitting here with author Ryan Winfield. And Ryan, the show is called Time Out with Sylvia Crowley, obviously, and on this show, I highlight timeout moments. And so when you think about a timeout in sports, that's the period of time where both teams are forced to pause, assess the situation, correct or adjust some things, regroup, and then resume with the opportunity to perform better. And so on the show, I interview people about those timeout moments that have caused you to kind of take a step back, think about what you're really doing, correct some things, regroup, and then have an opportunity to get it better the second time. So with that in mind, what would you consider your greatest timeout moment to be? I'm sure you've had many, as we all have. But what would be the greatest timeout moment that you've ever had?
Well, it's a great question, and certainly worthy of naming your show after. I think the greatest timeout moment that I've had would have to be a period of time in my life when I was just getting into writing full time. Because to do it the way that I wanted to do it and needed to do it, I needed to take the plunge and do it full-time, which is scary because you don't know if you're going to be able to earn any money, and you don't know if anybody's going to like what you've written. And I had been taking screenwriting classes, and I had been screenwriting almost full-time in all my spare time. And I had this screenplay for South of Bixby Bridge, which later became my first novel. And it had moved its way up in the consideration for the Sundance Institute screenwriting lab, but didn't ultimately make it. And I didn't know what to do with it. Here I had this thing I'd put all this work into, and I didn't know what to do with it. I knew some people in Hollywood and who were successful in the screenwriting business, but, you can't expect them to do you favors. But the story wouldn't leave me alone. So I had this crisis of, is this something I ought to be doing, or am I being unrealistic, and should I go, sell funeral plots or something, which was I actually considered for a period of time. And I have been a bit of a mountain climber and more of a hiker, but I decided to climb Mount Rainier, which we're blessed to have in our backyard here in Washington, but it's not an easy climb. You know, it's a glaciated peak, and it takes 2 or 3 days to climb, and it can be quite treacherous. So I scheduled the climb, and you know, we got all of our gear ready and trained for it, and up I went. And the entire time, you know, step after step, hour after hour of this grueling climb just up to base camp, I was thinking about, you know, what I was going to do and whether or not I had what it took to be a rider. And we leave from base camp, which is about 10,000 feet, at midnight to head for the summit, and we climb in the dark up over the glaciers and through steep terrain and wearing headlamps, and it was really quite an experience. But we summited just about sunrise, and to step up onto the top of the highest peak in the lower 48 states and to stare out on morning on all of God's creation in this perfect day, and just to see, it was like I was looking down. There must have been 300 miles of visibility, but it was more than that because there was 35 years of visibility, because I could see my entire life laid out before me and the path that I had taken to get where I was. And it was, and despite all the stumbling along the way and all the false starts and dead ends and things that left me cowering in the corner when I was experiencing them, from up there, they all were necessary and they all made sense. And there was something beautiful about the way it had all happened. And in that moment, I knew I was a rider and I knew I couldn't do anything else. And I came down from the mountain and I started writing that screenplay as a novel. And I almost entirely by hand with pen on pad of paper. And I completed it and I published it. And that was my first book. And it started everything.
Now, how did that experience change your perspective? Like, what lessons did you learn from that timeout moment?
I think I learned to trust. As a writer, you're always looking for meaning in things, sometimes trying to assign it where it doesn't belong. But I learned to trust that there really are no coincidences, and that everything is as it ought to be, and that there really doesn't need to be any fear about anything, because I'm not attached to the outcome, you know, because there is no outcome that is going to make me okay or fix me. That it's the process, it's the doing that is what's worthwhile. And if you just turn everything over to the universe, whatever that is, and trust whatever higher you might have to deal with the outcome, and then just do the work, you know, one step at a time, put one foot in front of the other. You can't write a book by thinking about writing a book. You have to write a book one word, and then the next word, and then into a sentence, and then a paragraph, and then a chapter. So it's the same as climbing a mountain. And so I think I came down with that awareness, that conscious awareness that I would be fine no matter what, and if I just did what I loved.
Wow. I love that. Everything is as it ought to be. I wish we all could have that perspective.
Well, but it doesn't mean I'm always happy with it. You know, it might be very uncomfortable what I'm in the middle of, but it's probably the way it ought to be.
Wow. So do you have any other timeout moments? That would be your greatest one. What would be another timeout moment that you had that you feel like was life-altering for you? Let me say this, Ryan. Because, and the reason why I ask people to share their timeout moments with our listeners is because you can Google you and, you know, just kind of look you up, and it looks incredible on paper. You know, you have a bestseller and you've written, you know, 3 books and they're all doing well. And so I think when you share your timeout moments, it helps people understand that the route wasn't always easy for you, number one. It connects you with our listeners because they'll feel like in the end, if he can do it, maybe I can do it. You know, maybe everything is as it ought to be. And so so I want you to share those moments so our listeners can kind of learn from your experience. So what would be another timeout moment for you?
Well, I think the largest timeout moment in my life, the most important, is probably the day that I got sober. And my first book that we just talked about, South of Bixby Bridge, is about a young 30-year-old man trying, you know, hitting his bottom and making a decision to get sober. Mm-hmm. And that story started very much as my own story, almost as a memoir. And it quickly grew into something other than that, and it is fiction, and it is not a memoir. The character became his own person to me, and the story took on, you know, things that I hadn't experienced that are different from my own experience, mm-hmm. which is good. But that it began as that, and it began with this image for me of a young man in the window of a drug rehab center that he was about to be let out of, looking out on, you know, the morning sun rising on all of Fresno, California, and him not being sure if he's an alcoholic or an addict or what his problem is, and thinking he's hit rock bottom, but not being sure. And so I had that image, and that very much was a place that I had been in my life, and I think I was writing to try and understand that. I had already been sober for several years when I was writing about it, but I think I was trying to understand it better, and I certainly did by the time I finished the book. I had a stronger sense of where I was and why. But that whole, I don't know if it's that moment, you know, that me standing in that window looking out on a sunrise at the end of a successful stay in treatment and thinking, you know, what's lies ahead for me, that certainly would be a timeout moment that would probably be more important than all the others.
Now, how did that experience change your perspective?
Well, I mean, that's all it did is change my perspective, and I don't know that I could. Here's the challenge with discussing things that are so emotionally nuanced for me is it takes me about 100,000 words to say anything, and that's why I write novels. So it's really hard to condense. But it was just a change of perspective. That's the thing about it is the world. You know, when I went from being drug addicted, alcoholic, you know, driving my life into the ground, which I very much was for a period of time. When I went from that to being the sober, productive member of society, having an entirely different experience, the world didn't change, you know. Nothing about the world changed, and nothing about anybody else in the world changed. What changed was the way I looked at the world, and it's almost like being given a new pair of glasses, and you put them on and are just floored by how different everything looks from the way you thought it looked all your life, mm-hmm. because you weren't aware mm-hmm. that you had a vision problem until you're giving these rose-colored glasses which to look at the world through. So it changed everything about my perspective.
Isn't it amazing how in hindsight you can look back, especially as a writer, and see that all the things that you've gone through actually were a blessing in disguise, because it's now writing material that makes you a best-selling author. You know, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. Do you ever think about that and it just totally blow your mind?
It does. I wouldn't encourage anyone to necessarily do research the way that I did research for the first 30 years of my life. I couldn't guarantee that they'd live through it. I'm not certain why I did. But yeah, living an interesting life and experiencing, because it wasn't always you know, low bottom and down and out. There was a lot of interesting things that happened along with that, and so it becomes great material to write from, and the emotional aspect of it becomes great material to plumb the depths of, and it's endless, you know, because you can keep looking at it from different angles and from different characters' points of view, and so yeah, it really helps.
Mm-hmm. Now, usually novels are fiction, and you said that South of Bixby Bridge was based on your story, but Jane's Melody, I want to move into that book, is so descriptive and so graphic that I can't help wonder if you base some of that on true experiences or experiences that you've encountered along your journey, or is this actually a book that you just kind of made up?
Well, to clarify on Bixby, when I began writing it, it began very much as my story. But the end product, by the time I'd finished the screenplay and then the novel, is completely different than my experience.
Right.
So, Jane's Melody, here's the thing. I think Hemingway had a saying that I really love, which is that all great books have one thing in common, and that is that they're truer than if they had actually happened.
Hmm.
And what I think it means by that is when a writer is really doing it right, and when you're really in it, and when you're really working at the craft, and that sometimes somehow elevates to an art form, and the end result, the story, is truer than if it had really happened. And the fact that you feel that way about James Melody, that it must have come out of some true experience, tells me that I might have accomplished that, and that, so I take that as a great compliment. Now, that being said, I certainly put personal experience, personal emotional experience, and sometimes other experiences into every character I write.
Mm-hmm.
But I do that with every character, not with one. So that means I'm Jane, and I'm also Caleb, and I'm also Jane's judgmental mother, and I'm also the old lady. So, you know, you have to be able to do all of it.
Right. I that was a compliment, because as I was reading your book, I felt like I could see the raindrops on the windshield, you know, and I could see the guy who was playing the guitar outside, and she's staring at him. Like, I could almost see a movie as I was reading the book. And so I felt like, did he make this up? Like, is this a fiction story, or is this drawn? Like, was he walking down the street and he saw this stuff happening? Like, where does this come from?
Let me tell you,
I'm hooked. My plan was to just read maybe one chapter of the book and just kind of figure out what the plot was. I'm like on chapter 8. You got me hooked.
Well, if you're on chapter 8, things should just be heating up. So.
Yes.
Yeah. But
now,
I'm glad that you have a visual experience with the reading, because writing is a very visual art form for me. The stories come to me in the form of images, and my job as a writer is to get those images down on paper before they disappear. And so the prose is the music, if you will, but the writing, the English major stuff, if anything, for me, that gets in the way of the storytelling. That's the limitations of my language, of my lexicon, or the words that I have the ability to use appropriately. The limitations of that limit my ability to tell the story based on the pictures I'm seeing. So I'm working always on the craft of writing itself. But the conjuring up the images to write down is something very different entirely.
You know, I think whenever I write something for my website or something like that, I'm going to have you proofread it. Because you are such a gifted writer. Oh, my goodness. So,
but I'd be a terrible proofreader, because we break all the rules, you know. The story first and rules that come second. I didn't, for instance, my first novel, which you haven't read, South of Ixtry Bridge, I didn't use a quotation mark in the entire book. There's a lot of dialogue.
That would drive me crazy, I think.
Well, but you have to read it and see. Some people love it. It adds to the experience, and some people have a difficult time with it. But I also didn't use, I don't think I used one L-Y adverb, at least, and that's, you know, a 90,000-word book without an adverb in it, because I was experimenting with some things. But so we break rules in the name of art. So I'd be a terrible proofreader.
Yeah, I break rules in the name of art too. Now, James Melody is a romance novel, right? However, it starts with tragedy. So what inspired you to write about tragedy in contrast to romance?
I wish I could say that it was a conscious decision and take more credit for the story or for the plot, but we've kind of touched on earlier, I really don't know where these things come from. And I don't know if I'd categorize it as a romance. I would call it a love story. But it very much came to me in the form of that opening image that you see when you read the book, which is Jane at the cemetery watching the rain fall on her daughter's freshly covered grave. That's the image I had. And I think it came to me, I was taking a bath or something, and I had this image of a woman having just buried her daughter and returning to the cemetery in the rain. And the image wouldn't let me alone, so I began writing about it. And when I began writing about it, then Caleb showed up at the grave. I didn't know he was going to be there that way when I was writing it. So it all unfolded in a very organic way that left me asking, where the hell did that come from? So it wasn't a conscious decision.
Right. Now, if you are just tuning in with us, you're listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. I'm sitting here with Ryan Winfield, who is the author of South of Bixby Bridge. He's also the author of the Park Service Trilogy, and there's different series within that. And he's also the author of bestseller Jane's Melody. Now, Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like South of Bixby Bridge and Jane's Melody are both books about characters who hit rock bottom and then they find love or romance, and there seems to be this emotional roller coaster ride that you take your readers on. Now, Park Service is different from those two books, but the other two seem to be have a similar storyline, and I personally think you're very gifted at it, but do you think that this is becoming your niche or your personal writing preference?
I don't know. I mean, I like to explore all kinds of different styles of storytelling, and what you're viewing is the work of mine that's been published because I've decided it's ready to be published or because it ended up being in some form that is publishable. But I, what you're not seeing is I have drawers full of stories that aren't published, novels, screenplays, books of poems, songs. So, I mean, I explore all different kinds of writing. I really enjoyed writing Jane's Melody. I really enjoyed writing a love story. The characters are still kind of stuck with me. I find myself curious about where they are and how they're getting along as much as my readers do. So I haven't written off that I may write more about them. I'll plan a trip to head down to Austin and see if I can find them because, you know, I need to be there, and I mean, I really will. I'll need to walk around the town and see if, you know, if a story comes to me, because if it doesn't, I can't write it. But, and the Park Service trilogy was very different. You know, it's a 15-year-old boy and a dystopian, utopian future, and but they're rewarding in different ways. And Bixby was different. I would consider it more literary fiction, if you can call it that, or real-world fiction. It's much less a love story than Jane's Melody, so... I would try to avoid finding my niche because then I think I might get bored.
Some people believe that, you know, you have to find a niche and then just kind of stay within that because that's what you've mastered and perfected. But it sounds like to me that you really don't want a particular niche. You want to be able to write, you know, you don't want me to put you in a box, Ryan. You want to be free write about whatever you want to write about.
Well, I have no illusions to the fact that I do this for a living and that I need to be able to entertain readers because at the end of the day, a writer only can write and make a living doing it if he writes stories that people want to buy and read. And I really value the position I'm in. I'm aware that there are people who get up and do very hard jobs all day long to earn the money necessary to run their lives and their families and have some left over for entertainment, which hopefully includes reading books. And so I get up and treat my job very seriously like a job and work and write every day because that's, you know, an honor to be able to do it, be paid to do it. So I'm aware that I need to write stories that readers want to read. So, but I also want to explore things that challenge me. So I can, you can do both. I don't think that they need to be mutually exclusive.
Okay. So you are a full-time author or writer. Do you do any other work besides writing?
No.
Just writing.
I do a lot. Just writing, that's it. Yeah.
Oh. And you said earlier that you like to mountain climb. Are there any other hobbies that you have outside of reading and mountain climbing?
I like to hike. I like to mountain climb. I do hot yoga. I like
hot,
to
what, wait,
yoga.
What's hot yoga?
Yeah. You know, where they heat a room up to 110 degrees and pump it full of humidity and you stand there in a puddle of your own sweat and contort yourself in all kinds of ways that are uncomfortable and hope that you don't pass out and they need to call an ambulance. But
I have never done hot yoga.
Well, that's the thing. So I do that, and I try and stay active and work out more for mental health and spiritual health than anything. Those are great outlets for me, going to the gym or going for walks. And so I do all that, and then I read and I write, and that's about it. I mean, I don't collect porcelain monkeys or anything or have any hobbies like that. I like to travel. I love to travel. Okay. I'm engaged, and my fiancé loves to travel, and so we pick up any chance we can. We're in a really unique situation where I can work from anywhere and she can work from anywhere, and so we fold up the laptops and jump on airplanes pretty regularly and go hide out somewhere and experience a new place and a new, you know, so that travel.
Wow. Well, congratulations on being engaged.
Thank you. We've been engaged for about 3 years, but we keep taking honeymoons instead of getting married. So.
Now, you would think to write a romance novel that you would probably be a romantic person. So what would be your idea of a romantic date with your fiancé?
Well, you'd be better ask her that question and see if I'm romantic or not. But I, you know, we have for our last anniversary, we had a boat, and we just recently got rid of it in order to facilitate our traveling. But we had a boat, and I decorated it with fairy lights and with food and flowers, and very much recreated this very magical first date that she had created for me 3 years prior on the same boat, and we had a very romantic evening there. So spent the night on the boat. So maybe it'll make it into a book sometime, and then you can read more about it. But
yes, the next book. Ryan, for people who are listening and possibly want to write a book, can you explain the process of how to write your first book? Like, what's the process that you go through? I think people are nervous of the process. So can you explain that to our listeners?
I get that question a lot, and I wish I could. I wish there were a process, but I don't know what the process is, because my process has been different for every book and continues to be different. I mean, when I wrote the first book for the Park Service, I went and rented a place on Oahu, on the beach, and I went there and I wrote, and that's all I did. I would wake up at 5 in the morning, I would sit down, brew coffee, have oatmeal, sit down, and I would write. And then I would close the laptop at noon, I'd go for a walk on the beach, get dinner, surf, whatever, come home, and I was in bed before sunset. And I did that every day for 30 days in a row, and I came home with a completed book. Jane's Melody, I wrote very different. My first book, South of Bixby Bridge, I originally wrote as a screenplay, and then I wrote the rest of the book on paper and pad and pen, mostly in coffee shops. So my process has been different for every book. It continues to be different for every book. I don't know how to tell someone to do it. I know this. I've heard a saying somewhere that I really like and agree with, and that is that you can tell a writer because they write.
That's pretty simple.
Well, so the answer is you can't, if someone really has a book in them and if they really need to write it, you can't stop them from doing it. They'll do it. Words are free. Everybody can get their hands on paper and get a pen. And so you have to do it. But I guess the advice that I would have for someone is write, that you have to do it all the time on a regular basis, and you have to be willing to write a lot before anything is worth being read or published. You have to have a lot of work that is just sitting in a drawer that is not going to make it into the final manuscript or the story, because it's like anything, it's a craft, and you have to practice. And I'm assuming when you were a professional basketball player that you got there by practice, practice, practice. I mean, how many baskets did you make when the game clock was not ticking? I guarantee it's a lot more than the baskets you made when the game clock was ticking, because you practiced.
My Lord.
Practiced.
And how many did I miss in order to
be able
to make?
It's the same thing. So my advice for writers is write often, write all the time, and be very slow. In this world, in today's world, you know, there's no barriers between you and the reading world. Anybody can publish. So my advice is to be very slow to publish, because you have to have a lot of respect for the other people on the other end, that you've put your work into your craft and you've made it as best as you can, and it's ready to be read.
Right. So basically, write first and then find a publisher. Is that the next step? What's the next step after you've written a lot, you've got some work in your drawer, and you've got some stuff that you've tossed out, and now you feel like this is what I'm going to present. Then what's the next
step?
Well, I
think a lot of people still do the traditional route where they try and secure an agent first. But more and more commonly in today's world, people self-publish. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's the right way to go, because if you have a story that's completed, then you have the ability to publish that yourself as an ebook or even as sometimes a print book, and then get that out to an audience. And if readers like it, it will find an audience. You know, it will begin to become popular, or at least you will get feedback that will help you hone your craft, and the next one might get more popular. So I think that, you know, you have to put the work in, and then when you have something that's ready, you publish it, you try and find an audience.
Okay. Now, for those who may have written a book before, can you explain what you did marketing-wise for your books to become bestseller? Can you share the secret? This is exclusive for our timeout listeners.
Sure. Okay. Here's the thing. I wish there were a secret to share. There's not. Everybody's looking for one, and I get my inbox is. I respond personally to every reader message I get. It's one of the highlights of what I do. I spend the first 2 hours of every workday, after my breakfast and after my coffee, replying to readers. I love it, and they're all very personal to me. But I unfortunately have to wade through countless messages from other writers who want to know what the secret magic bullet is to marketing and making yourself a bestseller. And I've gotten to the point, I used to respond to them, I've gotten to the point where I don't bother because there is none. And you have to do everything. I mean, I've heard it said before that half of the money you spend in marketing or half of the efforts that you put into marketing are a complete waste. The problem is you don't know which half. So you have to do it all. And that is very much true. But the challenge with marketing is it's not what I'm interested in, so I do it only to the degree that I have to. What I'm interested in is the craft of storytelling and in writing, and so that's where I focus all of my energy, all of my efforts, all of my time, and that's where they ought to be focused, because if you write a really, really good book, then marketing it is easy. And you don't have to look far beyond Hollywood to see that. And what I mean by that is they come out with countless movies that they spend $100 million marketing. You can't help but know about them. They're peppered on the side of every bus that passes by and on your television screen and on your laptop. And then the movie comes out and the movie isn't very good and it's an absolute flop. And they've spent $100 million marketing it. And there are other films that come out with very little advertising budget and the film is done very well and they take off and they become huge successes. And of course, there are mixes of the both. A good film will be a better film if it's marketed right. But you have to start with a really good book. So if you gave me, you know, endless money to advertise a book that's not a good book, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Now, how has social media helped you to push your books that you have out?
I think it's been everything for me. And what I mean by that is I decided really early on when I was connecting with readers that I wanted to do it through Facebook, because I have friends who blog, and I know other writers who blog, and it seems very one-way communication to me. You know, you write a post, and then you put it up, and people can read it, but they can't really interact with you. So I decided, since I value interaction with readers above everything, that I was going to spend almost all of my time on Facebook. So for the last two and a half years, I've been on there replying to everybody's comments, replying to all the emails I get on there. And it's not work. I mean, I really enjoy it. I've met some really wonderful people and had some really amazing and enriching experiences hearing from people who were moved by my books or affected by my books. So I've just focused my efforts there, and that has really helped grow it. It's made it a place I think that's fun for people to come interact with me, and it, you know, they're not just reading a book by some, you know, guy they don't know. They get to know me a little bit as a person. So social media has been everything. And then I think those people going out and being advocates on social media, sharing about the book and telling their friends on Facebook to read it or Twitter or wherever people interact, that has been immensely helpful.
Right. You and I met on Facebook. I inboxed you and asked you to do this interview, and you said, sure, I'll do it. So,
there you go.
I mean, there are some people who are against Facebook and social media, but, I mean, I think that social media can be so powerful if you know how to use it. I mean, in my opinion, President Barack Obama won the election through social media and technology, you know. So, how many Facebook friends do you have, by the way?
Well, I don't. You mean they call? I don't like the term, but they call Facebook calls them fans, or how many likes do I have? Because it's grown beyond what they allow you to have for friends. So
mm-hmm.
we have 135,000 is the answer. And,
wow.
But here would be my advice to anybody on that. You might be able to. There are some Facebook pages that have a lot more than what we have because the person is already famous, and maybe you can't interact with that person there. But
mm-hmm.
for me, it all depends on what your motive is. If your motive is to be very popular and have a bunch of likes, then it won't work because you're setting out with the wrong intention. The only reason
mm-hmm.
I have that many likes is because I value the relationship with the people out
right.
there, and with many of them have had some kind of interaction, replying to a comment, reading a comment, and so it's evidence of another underlying value, which is this relationship that I've built. If you
right.
just had a page where I had gone out and advertised and picked up 130,000 likes, it'd be worthless because they wouldn't know anything about me. They'd just be on the page.
Right. Hmm.
So you have to do work.
Ryan, please tell our listeners a website or a social site where they can keep up with you.
Well, Facebook's the best, and I think if they just type my name in the Facebook, I'll show up, Ryan Winfield. I think the handle is facebook.com/Ryan Winfield. Or if they go to my website, which is ryanwinfield.com, there's a link there to go to Facebook.
And Twitter, I believe, is Winfield Ryan, at Winfield Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah, Twitter's backwards. And I'm Twitter challenged because they only allow you 160 characters and it takes me 100,000 characters to say anything.
Maybe that's
so.
Why I'm Twitter challenged too. I
yeah.
just really can't get into Twitter because you can only do about 30 words or so. But
yeah.
So Ryan, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with us tonight.
Sure.
One of my favorite all-time quotes is that 5 years from now, you'll be exactly the same except for the books you read and the people that you meet. And that quote is a short way of saying we are a sum total of our experiences. But when we read books and meet new people, we get to view their experiences, and you grow as a person in your perspective. And today I have grown from encountering your books and hearing about your journey and your experiences. So I thank you for being on the show tonight.
Well, I thank you for having me. I feel the same after having met and talked with you.
Oh, no problem. Now, to our listeners, I encourage you to tune in next week for an interview with Tanya Bianc, who is the author and producer of Army Wives. And Army Wives is a Lifetime hit reality series that that is playing. And I, myself, am an Army wife, so I'm so looking forward to it, along with all the other Army Wives here at Fort Knox, Kentucky, where I live. So don't miss it. That's our time for tonight. I challenge you this week to read more books, preferably one of Ryan Winfield. I thank you for taking time out to be with us this evening, and I ask that you will just have a blessed week.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice, wait. Hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, future's looking bright.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.